we have time for some questions. Two points I might make before we start. Carl has the microphone, and if you wait for the microphone and talk into it and hold it horizontally, that will help with the acoustics. I was just going to mention that for those of you who did not know, about a year and a half ago, we held one of our policy forums with Andrew Colson and featured his book with two other speakers. So if you're interested, that information is on our website, and you can access it. The second thing is the mention of the idea of having private vouchers, which is a program that we operate also here called the Independent Scholarship Fund, and it's operated by one of our employees. His name is Catherine Shearer, who does an excellent job. And this particular program is aimed at students in Alameda and Contra Costa counties, and provides up to $1,500 per child to pick the school of their choice. We're now working, I guess the past year we were working with about 100 schools, and we provide over about 200 scholarships currently. We're hoping to greatly increase that, but as what was mentioned, the number of applicants is like five times or more. It's a huge demand for these kinds of options. So let's start with questions, and do you want to pick your own questions, or do you want me to? Okay. How about the gentleman right there?
Yes, I was curious. How do you explain the failure of public education and reconcile that with the dynamics of our economy? We have the most dynamic economy in the world, I think, and it's also technologically the most dynamic. And I'm a very big fan of privatization, but I just don't know in my mind what is going on here. Are the kids learning something else in our schools that we can't account for?
You don't need that many cheese.
Use the mic, John.
Oh. The old chiefs and Indians story, and we don't have many chiefs, but you don't need that many, and we import a heck of a lot of them. Plus, private schools, homeschooling. There's incredible competition for homeschool kids to go to colleges because they're so much more prepared. So that's a large part of the story. And then there's the Abraham Lincoln explanation, namely that you can excel without an education or a formal one, as many people do. I went to public school. And it's not like it's a death sentence. But, there are people succeed in spite of any system. And some succeed by escaping it, but some succeed even though they're in it. And so that's enough to make our economy work pretty well. Although I'm not sure we can keep stealing the brains from the rest of the world as a major component of the success that you described.
Do I have some of that? Well, picking up on that very last point, which gets to another topic that David and I have a common interest in, immigration. One thing that keeps the economy going is that sort of makes up for some of the failures of the educational system is that we are able to import a significant number of very talented people from other parts of the world, and I, for one, support that. But it's sort of a safety valve that gives us some protection against the inadequacy of the educational system. There is a literature out there, and how accurate it is, who knows? John Bishop at Cornell, for example, has argued that our productivity slowdown in America that happened after about 1970 was at least partly caused by the decline in the quality of American schooling. And that as the economy becomes more a skill-based economy, based more on mental effort and less on physical skill, the importance of schooling becomes greater. And homeschooling is a safety valve, as John mentioned. Immigration is another safety valve. We're looking for ways to sort of get around the system, of which these are two, homeschooling and immigration are two good examples.
Richard, you didn't mention charter schools at all, and you sort of, yes. But in the context of the environment in which we find ourselves, I mean, the political environment and the evidence that we've had about the public's inability to understand and buy into anything that resembles choice, like the voucher initiatives that have failed so miserably, not only in California, but in Michigan. And a tremendous amount of education is going to take to get through to people who don't understand economics at all, you know, much less understand anything you said tonight. It seems to me, and you know, just from the point of view of me putting, you know, the camel's nose under the tent, that if you go the charter route, and I have just read today something by Paul Hill about charter districts, not charter schools, but charter districts, where the whole district, because it's so dismal, is made into a charter, and exactly what you were talking about, John, which is the choice of curriculum is made available. So you have a Montessori school, you have a, you know, traditional kind of E.D. Hirsch school, you have any number of choices that are charters within a district where parents can choose to send their kids to the best school for them. I mean, the ideal thing would be if every school in this country had a curriculum that was appropriate for any child in this country.
Giselle, is your question for either of them?
Yes. I mean, I'd like to know how they respond, I mean, what they have to say about charters in that context.
Well, it's certainly a system that's far superior to our own, but I'll quote from my book, a gentleman that I have included in the dedication, that charters are a detour and a devastatingly bad one. That doesn't mean that they're not better than what we have, and it may turn out that they're the only game in town, and that's as far as we're going to get. But they lack those ingredients that we need for competition to create a dynamic of continuous, relentless improvement. They may make some initial improvements, but then they may be stuck there. So that's what I'd like to avoid. But certainly I have an open mind on that, again, because it may be the only game in town. We may need to ride that horse as far as it's going to go, because there may not be another horse.
Yeah, that gets to the issue of sort of this political strategy. And I agree exactly with John. Charter schools are a far inferior system than the model that we're talking about. For example, prices are critical, as John mentioned. The fact that schools can charge different prices is critical to mention. That's not even involved at all. But at the same time, I agree with the thrust of your question. I spend a lot of time dealing with state legislators. I do a lot of speaking to legislators. And, you know, when push comes to shove in the short run, I'd rather have a charter school system than not have a charter school system. So I'm asked, well, what do you think about liberalizing charter schools? My answer is I'm all for it, because going back to John's last point about what risk is there in tinkering with the system, I mean, the current system, you can't get any worse, can't go downhill. Anything you do is going to be equal or better than what we have. And what Lisa Keegan, the superintendent of public instruction, is doing in Arizona with charter schools, I think it's a step forward, and I support it, and I'd like to see it. But it does take away the impetus to truly call it radical reform, but needed reform, that brings about an element of true competition and true diversity. Although I agree with your comment, you do get away from the one-size-fits-all mode when you have charter. And I'm sorry, I had thought about putting charters into my remarks, and I said, hey, I'm going to be talking too long as it is, so I better, you got to cut something.
Well, just one final comment, and I feel charter law is quite consistent to what the vast majority of states have produced.
Yeah.
Leader of the charter group, I can't remember the name of the group, but she says, I get to see regulation of charters are really exempt from.
Yeah.
So. Oh, I forgot to do the microphone.
If you want to get a decent education, you have to start with decent teachers. On each of your plans, what happens to teacher salaries? That's one question I have. And the other is special ed kids who have special needs. Sometimes the cost of their services approach six figures each. What happens to those kids under each of your models, and what do the parents do with those kids?
Well, first of all, those kids need specialized services, not a little enclave in a school and where they're part of the time, and then the rest of the time they're put in with other kids to pretend that they really aren't that different from them, the mainstreaming. First of all, there's federal funds. My book says that they should continue to benefit from those federal funds as supplements to the vouchers that everybody gets, and as a safety valve, both public and private should provide money for supplement to those vouchers for the truly special needs kid. Now, the actual number of special needs kids is way overblown by the current system. Because if you have a giant school, there's going to be a lot of kids that are going to be way away from the so-called average or mainstream kid, and they're going to be taught, some of them are going to be taught by methods that just don't work for them. There's nothing wrong with them. They're just different methods for them would work fine. They'll be labeled special ed and medicated in some cases when all they need is a different arrangement, environmental arrangement, methodological subject matter, some different arrangement under which they could thrive. So the number of special ed kids would drastically decrease. They would be handled better by specialization, and the remainder should be helped by the federal funds already targeted for them, and by they should have larger vouchers or tax credits or whatever.
Now, you can give large vouchers to special ed. I mean, if you gave, say, a $5,000 voucher to an ordinary student, you could give a $30,000 one to special ed. But you're getting some problems with that, and that is, which we have right now. I wrote a story for the Wall Street Journal that got me more trouble than anything I've ever written called America the Disabled. Right now, there are certain incentives to being disabled. You know, if you're learning disabled, called LD, you have the rights to all kinds of special rights. You can have individual meetings and set up individual, what do they call it, Karen? In IEPs, yeah, IEPs. You have a right to an IEP. You know, I can get an IEP. All I have to do is have a kid who's learning. So the number of students classified as a special ed has soared relative to the total population for this year. One thing on the competition teacher salary. Mr. Hall and I in the back wrote an article for the Journal of Labor Research, the journal John writes for. We found that teacher salaries, public school teacher salaries, are enhanced by greater competition from private school. It's simply because there are more people out there looking for the teacher's services. There's more competition for the teacher services. So that, if anything, it tends to push salaries up. So if I were trying to start wars with the teacher union, and I'm all for it, by the way, that would be one thing I would be doing with a rank and file. Your leadership is trying to deprive you of opportunities to teach in other types of institutions, which may be preferable not only for money reasons, but for other reasons as well.
I remember in the 1950s personally being a consumer of public school services, and a very satisfied consumer. I mean, to the extent that when I moved into the Ivy Leagues, at least for my freshman year, I felt that the quality of my education had gone down. Now, when it came time to choose for my own son where to put him in school, I naturally thought, especially now that I'm living in a somewhat richer neighborhood than I grew up in, that I would put my son into a public school from which he would derive an education at least equal, if not superior, to the one that I received. I was, as you probably know, severely disappointed. And in fact, I've noticed a lot of people who are staunch believers in public school education tend to think about, if they're my age, tend to think about their own public school education and perhaps haven't really looked into that which their own children are receiving. Something happened between the 1950s and today. I mean, as a free market advocate, I look back at my public school education and I can't figure out how it was as good as it was. And that's actually one question I still have for myself, but I think the more interesting question is, what happened to public school education?
Okay. I can address that in general form. First of all, government, by definition, is politics, and politics is about passing rules, and so the number of rules have increased, and that diminishes the degree to which people can make choices, both as providers and as consumers. In addition to that, there's just so much more politics involved in so many of the decisions now. If you look at another great book, Public Education, An Autopsy by Myron Lieberman, he talks, and it's true, you can read in there about any number of interest groups that have veto power over just about anything, and what that's done to things like curriculum and textbooks, all the hoops that they have to jump through, and what that's done to the content. And as a result, you have these kind of the wishy-washy, what you can get past enough of the veto groups, and instead of having historically accurate content, for example, in a history book, you have to put a little bit of something in there for everybody to make them happy. Oh yeah, you put this in there, that makes our group. So you got to put this in there. totally distorts history, but it throws a bone to everybody. Since there's so many more hands up, the short of it is it's a progressive disease, and plus it's progressing more rapidly now because there are so many more factions involved in the various parts of the process.
You can't underestimate also, there are a lot of things. It's a multifaceted thing. I incidentally graduated from school in the 50s, and of the 30 students in my elementary sixth grade class, 12 went on to earn PhDs, and I went to a public school. So I have the same fond feeling you did. That's why I ran for a public school board and almost committed suicide shortly after. But thinking I was going to help people. But you can't underestimate the debilitating effects that so-called education colleges and all have, too. There is a strong anti-intellectualism, as Diane Ravitch and others have pointed out, among those people who do most of the teaching of teachers. And it's just another factor to this. And there's just this self-esteem movement, you know, that the purpose of school isn't to teach facts. It's wrong to teach the state capitals. Why should kids learn the names of the state capitals by rote memory? That's silly. They can look it up on the internet. I mean, this is the mentality goes through. I think it's useful to learn the multiplication tables. I think it's useful to know that the capital of California is Sacramento or whatever. Why? Actually,
right,
I just
down.
Destroyed my own argument. I'll shut up.
Getting back to the question that Giselle Huff asked earlier, how do we get the message out? You mentioned earlier that the message has been dumbed down. What is a good way of getting it out to the voters at large? Is it something like, if we build it, they will come, and by virtue of it working, more people will get involved, there'll be a critical mass?
Well, I'm certainly not an expert on making political messages, but if it were up to me, my starting point would be just a non-discrimination argument. I mean, that seems to be a big seller that wins court cases and it moves legislation. Let's treat everybody the same as a starting point. If their parents want a deluxe product, let them spend their money on that. But a starting point should be all children should be treated equally by their government. And if we do that, that's we're halfway there, at least halfway there.
You raise an interesting political, at least a thought occurs to me. There may be a threshold level politically. If you get, right now, we have 14-15% of our kids not publicly educated in the United States. It was about 11% 10 years ago. It's really not risen much. It hasn't changed much, but it's going up some because of homeschooling, because those are non-publicly educated, and that's now more than 3% of the total. It seems to me if you get a large enough mass of voters out there that are not part of the public establishment, and then you get another mass of growing sort of senior citizen people who are sort of disenchanted with the schools for a variety of reasons, thinking of them the way they did when they were younger people and so on, like the gentleman asked earlier, that maybe you get this critical mass that leads to the voters simply one way or the other saying no. And at the moment, that's happening all over. And the things that are saving the public schools right now are the courts. They're resorting to the courts because the normal political process is not providing enough bucks in many states. So this, you know, equalization movement that's going on all over the country is resorting to the courts to get what they can't get politically. But I don't know if that's a sustainable long-term strategy.
I'd like to ask a question about GATE education. I teach GATE mathematics in Union City, and I noticed that gifted and talented. Although by the time the children reach me, most of their interest in asking questions about mathematics has really been beaten out of them. I mean, they really, if our Silicon Valley depended upon their ability to do creative work, we would be in big trouble, which makes me wonder about when you're saying we don't need that many chiefs, will it continue in that direction? That's one. And the other one is, if we specialize, won't we naturally bring out the gifts that kids have in them already that aren't recognized by the current program?
Yeah, I agree with that. However, I do think that whole area of gifted and talented is an interesting area. because although every, not every school, a lot of schools pay lip service to the area, the whole notion of the common school, that we're all to be treated equal, sort of runs against the notion of gifted and talented. And so you have, and the word, a favorite word among educrats is elitism. I'm sick of that word. I love elitism. I'm for it. We should all, you know, let's rejoice in elitism. But, and sometimes it's hurt programs like this, and politically, I don't know how it is here in California and Ohio, it's a problem. My wife was a talented and gifted coordinator for, I think she lasted 62 days because of the politics.
Yeah, the Griffin name won't be in a lot of places.
A lot of your ideas are very sympathetic, and I just thought we'd bring it down to a practical problem. My daughter teaches 31 fifth graders in inner city in Oakland, and in it, the one-third of them are Chinese-speaking men, one-third are Spanish-speaking, and one-third are deprived kids, many of whose parents aren't together. Some of them live with their grandparents, and some live sort of day-to-day in different communities. What are the conditions under which your plans would deal with each of those 31 kids? Because I think if there's something at the bottom of our feelings of skepticism about your plan is that there'd be some kids that would be really left out. And I'm sure you've thought about the conditions. I'd just love to have you articulate them.
Well, first of all, it's a mistake to force them all to be in the same classroom because they have different issues to be addressed. And that's the first part, is the specialization part. That they need to be in a place where the teachers are specialized in each of their, they're not each going to get individual attention, but they have enough similarities that you could probably have a school for each one of the different conditions that you generally described. That would be the first part of it. And the other part is to create the ability to move, which would create the other part of the competition hammer, namely that you can lose your customers if you don't address them. See, now they're captive. Their needs are not being addressed. The issues that plague them, I think you want to, I don't know, that's not the right word for most of the, some of them, that's correct, but their issues need to be addressed, not in a, you all need to be the same, so we're all going to teach you the same and make you the same one way or the other, which is the current mindset. It needs to be, you're all different, and so we're going to deal with you with that reality in mind. I know that's an overly simplistic answer, but that's what you have to do. And there are going to be some significant problems from the fact is that we can't all start them off back at 6 years old.
We have to recognize also, and I don't disagree with everything John said, I do agree with public school teachers who say that the students today, in many cases, are coming from more disadvantaged backgrounds than a generation ago, not in the sense of income. Incomes are higher. But more broken families and all. And families do make a difference. Families do make a difference. But we shouldn't let that be an excuse not to try new experiments, new paradigm, because the old paradigm isn't working. The fact is, the people who are most disadvantaged by the current system are those coming from these very dysfunctional family backgrounds, or untraditional family backgrounds, broken families and so on. As to the immigrant experience, you know, I'm thinking back in the early 20th century New York City of all of the Italians and Hungarians and so forth who came in and were thrust into classrooms with no bilingual education or anything. And it took them a while, and there was disadvantage, and it was tough. But by gosh, they learned. There's no reason it can't happen. Yeah. He's an immigrant, by the way. He's from Germany.
But one in front, most have so many back.
We're done.
Professor Gutter?
Yes.
You, in the 19th century, when public schooling was started in this country, public money was to be used for the purpose of education, but they also made the calamitous decision to set up public structures, public apparatus to carry out these. Mm-hmm. And the teachers right. became public employees, subject to public authority. In the imaginary school system that you described just now, would there be a break in the authority of the school boards over these teachers? You describe it in the incorporation.
Yeah, my ideal in the long run would be there would be no school board. I mean, in the long run, there'd be no school board. In fact, if I were czar, the constitutional amendment on on schooling would say, education of children is a responsibility of parents. Period. And might go on and say a little more, but mostly like government cannot spend money. I really think we'd be in a pure world, we'd be better off having no government involvement whatsoever.
The only problem with that, and I think it's something that vouchers, you were saying, what is the message? I think the problem that I see with my friends and such is that those children whose parents don't give a damn are the kids who need it the most. So that particular position I can't see ever flying, certainly, and I'm from San Francisco. It doesn't like that part there, but the idea that the children who need it the most are the ones whose parents will not in any way, shape, or form take advantage of any of the things you're talking about. But I think there has to be a message that those children will be taken care of, and I think that would solve a lot of it. But leaving it up to the parents is not going to do it for those kids, and I think everyone's quite aware of that.
Well, a lot of parents will continue to send their children, barring some specialty that's just completely off the wall as far as they're concerned, will send their kids to the nearest school. And just like we all free ride on careful consumers and various things we buy, many parents will free ride on other careful parent consumers and will just say, you know, just like you walk down the grocery store shelf and pick up things, you get good products even if you don't read the label because other people do.
Right?
And so, you know, you get a safe car because some people pay attention to that even if you don't think about it very much. So it doesn't take a very large number of discriminating consumers to create a competitive and a pretty good system for everybody.
No, I agree.
Okay.
We're running low on time.
Yeah, I think we're running out of time.
I have an email address, so I'll answer all of those questions.
Go ahead.
jmerryfield@utsa.edu.
Well, now that we're throwing email addresses around, my email address is smaller than yours. Vetter@ohio.edu.
I want to thank both of our speakers tonight, Richard Vetter and John Merryfield, for their talk. This is obviously a huge issue, and there's a lot that needs to be done, and I strongly encourage you to get a copy of each of their books because they're critically looking at ways to make a real difference, and that is what's needed. And to be able to essentially advance this kind of thinking is what's going to make the difference. So if you're interested, there are copies upstairs. Both of them would be delighted to autograph copies for you if you so choose. I also want to thank all of you for joining with us and making our program tonight so successful. And we hope that it will lead to
the copy,
copies of John's paper right here if you're interested in getting a copy. And thank you all for joining with us. We hope to see you again on our next program. Good night.